Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. My next guest really needs no introduction. We're with Jim Peterick from the Ides of March, formerly of Survivor and 38 Special. And Jim has had just a legendary, just a tremendous career in rock music and in songwriting and production. In case you don't know Jim, in 1965, at age 14, he co-founded the band The Ides of March with his buddies up in Berwyn, Illinois. In the following year, he wrote and sang The Ides' first hit, You Wouldn't Listen, which reached number 42 on Billboard and number 7 in Chicago. And 4 years later, in 1970, he wrote and sang The Ides' million seller called Vehicle, which reached number 2 in Billboard and number 1 on Cashbox. Rumor has it that's the fastest selling single in Warner Brothers Records history. And I was telling Jim, not only is that a song that is regularly in my rotation, but my son, when I mentioned to him I was having Jim on the show, my son who's 28, I said, do you know that song Vehicle by The Ides of March? He sends me a snapshot of his iPhone and showing me it's in his most popular play. So I mean, what an epic accomplishment to write a song one generation, but to write a song multiple generations, man, that's just so wonderful. In 76, Epic Records released Jim's solo album called Don't Fight the Feeling. At that time, Jim was touring with Heart in Boston. In 1978, the Jim Peterick Band shifted personnel and they became Survivor. 80 through 81, Jim co-wrote hits for 38 Special, including Rocking Into the Night, Hold On Loosely, Caught Up in You, Wild-Eyed Southern Boys, and Fantasy Girl. He also co-wrote the theme to the film, one of the greatest soundtracks, period, Heavy Metal with Sammy Hagar. What an amazing title track that is. And he also co-wrote two albums with Henry Paul of the Outlaws. In 1982, Jim and Survivor had their first million seller with Eye of the Tiger, which was obviously the theme from the film Rocky III. Jim co-wrote, co-produced, and played keyboards and guitar on that song. That song stayed at number one for 7 weeks on the Billboard charts and won a Grammy, a People's Choice Award, and an Oscar nomination. 1984, Jim and Survivor released the platinum album Vital Signs, which produced 3 top 10 singles, I Can't Hold Back, High on You, and The Search is Over. And in 1985, Jim co-wrote the million-selling theme for Rocky IV, Burning Heart for Survivor. Hey, thank God Sylvester Stallone made Rocky, not just for him, right? In 1986, Jim co-wrote Is This Love, which again reached the top 10 for Survivor. Jim's also written songs for and with the Doobie Brothers, major motion picture soundtracks, The Questionnaires, and if you go back, look up Doug Lancio. I interviewed him recently, and you could check that out. King Crimson and Asia bassist and vocalist John Wetton, Cheap Trick, Christian artist Jillian, Blackhawk, Van Zandt. What a diversity in here, man. Lynyrd Skynyrd, REO Speedwagon, Cinderella, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, blues artist Anthony Gomes, Toby Hitchcock and Pride of Lions, Rock of Ages Broadway play, Dennis DeYoung, former lead singer, songwriter of Styx, and he's currently on tour with the Ides of March. Jim also co-wrote the Songwriting for Dummies book and an autobiography memoir called Through the Eye of the Tiger, and finally next year, in tribute to the Chicago Cubs, and with that song is played at all games at Wrigley Field and is included on an album sold at all major league ballparks. Jim, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Wow, I'm exhausted hearing all that.
We're done. Thanks.
Thank you. It's been a blur, but a beautiful blur, you know, of a rock and roll life. And, you know, I've always stayed very grounded. I'm able to do that because I have a great home base. You know, my wife, I've been married now to Karen for 47 years.
Wow.
God
bless you, man. That is so freaking cool.
She's my rock, you know, and I mean, she'll call a spade, believe me. She is not a Yoko Ono Klingon. No offense to Yoko. We all love her, especially her singing voice. But anyway, Karen is amazing. And I'll play her a new song and she'll go, well, you know, you could do better.
Hey, that's great, man.
So, and then we were blessed with a son. He's 28 now. He's married to a gal named Meredith. We have. I'm a granddaddy. I'm a purple grandpappy. And her name is Maisie. She's 16 months. We're just having a blast. So, you know, I like keeping balance in my life. That's the key word. I can do all that stuff, and I can write for 3 projects a week, but I got to stay focused on the home base.
Man, congratulations, because I've been with my wife 26 years, and I know it's not an easy thing. It's not like you wake up and fog a mirror and you're just there another day. It's a lot of work and commitment, man. So that's really nice to hear that.
It is. I'm distrustful of marriages who say, I never have a problem. Yeah, that's because you're holding it back, and then they explode. You know?
Yeah, good luck with that. Or, we never argue. We never yell. I'm like, yeah, okay. It's not a – you probably never talk to each other then.
I think that's what it is.
Hey, I don't even know where to start here, because your career has been so robust and you've had success in so many different areas. So I figured let's just start with the basics of maybe how you got into music in the first place, or when you picked up a guitar. And really what makes me curious is what prompted you to start writing, because that's not the common thing.
Right. Well, it was really my dad's influence, I think. He was a really good musician. He's no longer with us. He passed away in 82, right before Eye of the Tiger came up. But he was a sax player, and I have to call him a weekend warrior, because, you know, growing up in the Depression, he had to get a real job, you know. And he worked at the phone company adjusting relays in phones. But every weekend he did, as they called them, jobs with his band called the Hi-Hatters. I remember the stands. Their stands with a stencil of Hi-Hatters were stored in our basement. A great sax player, never read a note of music, totally instinctual like his father, who was born in Prague. I'm 100% Czech. And his father played concertina and anything that was put in his hands. My dad got that gene. I got that gene. So in fourth grade, I started taking sax lessons and played in the grade school band. But then I started joining my dad at jobs at places like the VFW hall, various men's clubs, weddings, a few bar mitzvahs. They did a lot of polkas. He was called Young Wayne King, Wayne King being this iconic sax player out of Wisconsin. My dad was Young Wayne King. And Jim Peterick Sr. was a very popular guy. You know, I would see the women just kind of looking up at him at the stage as he was doing a sweet solo. And I'm going, I like that.
That's great. And ironically, he had been married 47 years, though. So you didn't leverage that.
I leveraged it once to meet my future wife. We met at a Turtles concert, and music brought us together. That's all I can say. She went to an all-girls Catholic school. I went to the public school, high school, Morton West, which all the Ides went to. And I heard that the Turtles were going to be at Riverside Brookfield High School, and I was a huge Turtles fan. Like, who wasn't in that day? And the great songs that were written for them, and then, of course, they wrote a few on their own, but culminating with Happy Together. And I remember meeting this gorgeous gal in line, and I said to myself, she's way out of my league. I'll never get the nerve to talk to her. And she turns around to me and says, aren't you Peterick? And I go, yeah, last time I looked. And she said, I just saw the Ides of March last month. You opened up for the Crying Shames, and you guys were really good. We started talking. We sat together watching the Turtles do their magic, Flo and Eddie bumping butts on the stage and goofing around and horsing around. And then it got to Happy Together, and Karen put her leg on top of mine. I said, I'm there.
You must have felt like $1 million, man.
I still do.
Yeah, that's great, man. That's really cool, man.
It was a great moment. And her girlfriend sitting on the other said, Karen, what are you doing? And Karen goes, somehow I trust him. And, I don't know if I'm really trustworthy, actually, but it seemed to work.
Good for you, man. That's a great little love story there. I like that. Thank you. So where does your heart lie first, if that's an even question you can answer, as far as like, do you consider yourself a singer-songwriter who plays guitar and other instruments, or a guitar player who sings and writes songs?
Well, I'm your classic combo plate. You know, it's really all combines into one. I'm not one of those brilliant Nashville writers, and I don't mean that tongue in cheek. They're just some amazing writers who can sit in a cubicle all day with another writer and write these brilliant songs. I need field research. I need to get on stage. I need to get the inspiration of the crowd. So that doesn't really work for me. I mean, I can get with Don Barnes at 38 Special and we can write in the studio, but all the time I'm envisioning a song performed on stage. So the stage experience very much informs my songwriting. Guitar-wise, I'm a guitar-holic. I own 200 guitars, so that kind of speaks for my
wow
obsession. And I feel most like myself on stage when I have a guitar around my neck, which was what was really frustrating about Survivor. I had my biggest success with Survivor behind keyboards. And that was kind of by necessity because that was part of our sound. I'm not really a keyboard player. I could never do a solo where I can solo my butt off on guitar, but I can't do that on piano. Piano, I'm a writer's piano player. I know the cool chords and I know, you know, I played all the keyboards in Survivor and Search Is Over. That's me, but it's never where my heart was at.
Sure. So it's kind of almost bittersweet in a sense.
Yeah. You know, I mean, again, with Ides of March, we went on a 17-year hiatus in 1973. In the Ides of March, I was the guitar player, frontman, lead singer. In Survivor, I took a back seat in the second row and played keyboards. I was not the lead singer. I sang a few vocals, but very little. And that was the design of that band. But I always missed being the frontman, talking to the crowd, getting the crowd excited, jumping around, you know, foot on the monitor. I never got to do that with Survivor. So when I left Survivor in 96 and basically put my heart back into the Ides of March, it was like coming home.
Yeah. So it was a great decision.
It was. I don't regret it at all. And I still have my children from Survivor, which is the songs that are still out there doing their work. It was a wonderful era.
That's great. So I have to ask you some questions about vehicle, and I apologize because I know that some of these has been asked probably a bunch of times, but I'm asking these because, you know, as I said, I love the song. I really do. So I'm curious about it. And I hate to like ask you these. I'm not a conventional guy. This is not a conventional show. The song came out in 1970. Any particular setting or experience that the idea or for the melody or the lyrics came from or were inspired by?
Absolutely. And again, it goes back to that girl I met in line for with the turtles who was wearing orange culottes and knee socks and saddle shoes.
Culottes. I haven't heard that word
culottes.
40 years, man.
And it goes back to that girl. Because after the Turtles concert, we dated for about 6 months, and then she decided to dump me and said, you know, Jim, I love you, but not in that way. And that's the kiss of death to any guy.
Oh, my God.
Is there? You know, well, I want to date other guys. You know, you're the first guy I ever dated. You know, oh, my heart was, like, stabbed. And so I played the blues for a few months with the Ides. We would encore, and I would go into – you know, I would go into a B.B. King blues number as the audience walked away. And that's the kind of state of mind I was in. But a few months later, she started calling me again. And I had a car, which, you know, not everybody had in those days. It was 1964 Valiant, which was pretty darn cool with the push buttons and, yeah, all that, you know, torque flight transmission. And she said, well, Jim, you know, I know you got a car, and this is not a date, but could you take me to modeling school? I mean, she was 16 years old. I was 18. I said, sure, you know, and take her to modeling school. I thought I'd get a kiss or something. Nothing. So dropped her off. 2 weeks later, hey, Jim, that was really nice of you to give me that ride. You know, can you take me to modeling school again? I said, sure. Thought maybe this time I'd get lucky. Well, nothing. Pretty soon, I started getting a little resentful of the whole thing.
Sure. And your parents are probably like, Jim, you got to stop that. She's using you, right?
She's using you, yeah. And baby, if you want to use me up.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And that's kind of the way I felt. And I said to myself, man, all I am is her limousine service. All I am is her vehicle.
Wow. And
just loved that word. I'm a big freak for titles and words and You know, I have a kind of a knack for picking out catchphrases. Vehicle sounded tough, it sounded cool. And I thought of this horn riff that, I don't know, came from the heavens, the ba-da-ba-ba-da, showed it to the guys, wrote the song. It's really funny. The original first line was, I got a set of wheels, pretty baby, won't you hop inside my car? But it wasn't quite, didn't have the rhythm. And then I was sitting in biology class with my lab partner in senior year high school, and he was a stoner, and he would come to class totally baked. And he was, you know, they giggle a lot when they're stoned. And he brought me this pamphlet that the government had distributed to the high schools. And it had a little, one of those corny little cartoons of the friendly stranger. And it was kids to beware of this guy that might be cruising along the curb. And he's like cracking up. And suddenly I go, I'm the friendly stranger in the black sedan. Won't you hop inside?
Holy shit.
And it was like, oh man, there's the first line, you know? And so, you know, we rehearsed it. We hop into the studio. CBS Studios had a studio in Chicago, right on Fairbanks. Went in with our producers, Bob Stocky and Frank Rand, and we caught lightning in a bottle. It was just a magic take. We did two takes, and thank God we had a first take. The second take, this was very new technology. It was the first 16-track machine in the country. And the second engineer pressed the wrong button and erased 13 seconds of our master take.
Holy shit.
And if you listen to the track, right at the end of the second chorus, all the way up to the solo, it's take one. And this is, Craig, this is before the days of click tracks and playing the metronome. This was instincts. We didn't know what a click track was. And so it was absolutely miraculous that the insertion worked, surgery worked. I had to re-sing one line, and there you have it. The record came out in the spring of 70 on Warner Brothers Records, became the fastest rising, as you said, record in CBS's history, in Warner Brothers history. And my favorite story, and it's absolutely true, suddenly we're on the road with Led Zeppelin, opening up for them in Winnipeg and Calgary, Janis Joplin, doing shows with her. I walked her home to her hotel room because she was too under the weather to make it back.
Yeah, I hear.
A sweet soul, just a sweet gal. We toured with Poco, Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers Band, a lot of shows with them. Guess who starts calling me again?
Your girlfriend, your ex-girlfriend.
Hey, you know, Jim, maybe I was a little hasty in that decision, right? Maybe we should try it again. And I let her hang on the line, silence for at least 3 long seconds. And I go, sure.
Let's so you were it. Really smitten, even though, because you must have been party. You must have been like really pissed.
I was not only pissed. I knew that this was the girl. This was going to be it. And for her not to realize that just devastated me. You know, I thought it had to be mutual. It wasn't, at least not at the time. But since then, she got wise. She dated some other guys. You know, she knew I was the best boy for her. And we got back together. And in about another 6 months, we started making marriage plans. And, you know, 47 years later, I'm still her vehicle.
There you go. Hey, man, it must be some satisfaction that, like, I'm sure you've paid a shit ton of taxes to the government that you got the line from a government pamphlet. Have you ever thought of that? Like, you know, it's like, you know, equity. It's an equitable trade.
I never thought of it. And yet, I don't feel any better about paying taxes.
Mm. Of course. I bet, man.
Not even.
That's great. What a cool story, man. Thank you so much for sharing that. That was such an awesome. I mean, it's amazing. You know, when you look back, the multiple serendipities. That it wasn't like one event, it was this, and then in a class, and then this guy brought the pamphlet in, and
and those, to a lot of people, those are boring stories. To me, it's fascinating. You know,
crazy, man. Are you kidding?
Yeah. I mean, and again, there's always a confluence of events to the best songs I've written. Hold On Loosely, first song I actually co-wrote with 38 Special. They recorded Rockin' Into the Night prior to that, but that was a song that I wrote with Survivor that they got a copy of, and and recorded really against our, not against our wishes, but without our knowledge, which is a very interesting story. But the first time we really got together to write a song was in 1981. John Kolodner, I don't know if you're familiar with that name.
Yeah, is he a producer or something?
A&R man.
Okay.
Yeah, famous A&R man with Atlantic, then another company, Geffen. He was the bearded, Hasidic, Jewish-looking guy who was in the Pump video playing in a bride's dress, you know, very weird. I mean, he wasn't weird. He was weird, but he wouldn't wear a wedding dress normally. He was Dennis Rodman.
He wasn't Dennis Rodman. That's what I was thinking.
He wasn't that. He was my mentor, and he's the guy that put me together with Sammy, and he put me together with Aerosmith and most significantly 38 Special. So they came in to write with me, and we're sitting around my kitchen table, and Don Barnes is here, Jeff Carlisi is here. And, you know, a writing session is always like a blind date the first time you write with someone. And this was no exception. We're just kind of, you know, three rockers sitting there not knowing what to talk about. And suddenly Karen comes in with a plate of nachos and we all cracked open a beer. And suddenly the floodgates open. And finally people were able to feel comfortable, you know. And Don Barnes says, well, I got a title. And I said, go ahead, shoot. He goes, hold on loosely. And I said, yeah, hold on loosely, but don't let go. And suddenly I was thinking about Karen, because the first time we broke up, the main reason is that I was getting too serious. What do you call it when you're, I hate to use the word suffocating.
Smothering.
Smothering.
Yeah, yeah.
So jealous of anybody that, you know, it was too much for her. She wanted freedom, you know. So when Don said, hold on loosely, I immediately said, but don't let go. If you cling too tightly, you're going to lose control. Your baby needs something to believe in and a whole lot of space to breathe in. Holy crap, you know.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And then Jeff Carlisi goes, well,
you can't afford to lose your wife.
You can't. Oh, that's a funny, I keep thinking of adjunct stories. So I got Liberty DeVito over at the house a few years ago, Billy Joel's amazing drummer.
Yeah.
And he looks around my house and goes, Jim, you've never been divorced, have you? I go, what do you mean? I said, no. He goes, you still got all your shit.
No, I mean, you can't afford to lose her for inspiration purposes. She's like the muse for you, man.
Well, that too. That too. So anyway, Hold On Lucy was an organic thing. I wrote it out of experience. You know, and I was about to see Jeff Carlisi. He said, well, I got this little riff. It's kind of a Cars ripoff. And he goes, bam, bam. I go, yeah, I think we got something here. And suddenly, you know, as the nachos disappeared and we broke another beer open, we had a song.
That's so cool, man. It's just, it really amazes me how so many little things have to fall into place for things to happen like that, you know.
It's synchronicity. It really is. I mean, to move forward a little, you know, when Stallone, I got that message on my answering machine from Stallone. And you go, hey, yo, Jim, give me a call. It's Sylvester Stallone. I thought somebody was putting me on. You know, and I played for Karen. I said, does this really sound like Stallone? I mean, no secretary. It's a 213 area code. That was a good sign. She says, you better call him back. So I call him back, and I was really nervous because I was already a huge fan. My wife and I loved the first Rocky. Who didn't, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he answers the phone. Yo. And I go, hey. I said, he actually did. I mean, he is so in character. And I said, this is Jim Peterick. Am I really speaking to Sylvester Stallone? Hey, Jim, how you doing? Call me Sly, you know? And, okay, Sly, how you doing, bro? You know? And he was, couldn't have been nicer, and said, I love your band Survivor. I'm a big fan of the second album you guys did. Tony Scotti, you know, my good friend who owns your record company, played it for me, the song called Poor Man's Son. That's the sound I want for my new movie, Rocky III. Can you help me out? You know, by this time I'm like levitating. Yeah, I think so. He said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to send you the first 3 minutes of the movie. I can't send you the whole movie, but it's the montage. And this is what I want you to write the song of your life to, right? And I go, no problem. Okay, got it. So, I mean, it's funny. People say, how long did it take to write Eye of the Tiger? Well, Frankie came over, we watched the movie, we got inspired. I came up with that digga 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 dig bop bop bop. I was trying to time the punches with the chord slashes, and we caught lightning in a bottle. But I mean, we wrote that song and recorded it in 4 days.
Yeah.
But in reality, I've been writing that song all my life. You know, that couldn't have happened when I was 18. I hadn't lived enough. I hadn't experienced enough. But through all the struggles of, you know, the Ides of March trying to make it to the top, and then me losing my record deal, going solo, doing my 1976 Don't Fight the Feeling album, touring with Boston, being the low man on that totem pole, believe me, I learned a lot about defeat and a lot about rising up. And I put all that into Eye of the Tiger. It's the spirit. It's the rising up to the spirit of your rival. And that rival can be anybody. It can be yourself, or it can be someone else, or it can be the industry. It can be your relationships. You know, I couldn't have written that earlier. So synchronicity, it's all about that.
So let me ask this. People often mistakenly feel like, I think, when someone's successful in music or in any business, they seem to think that that's how it is. And people don't seem to realize that that's not how it is. You got to, you know, get your ass kicked immensely and then get through that and then, you know, crawl up the food chain, sometimes rapidly, some usually not, and, you know, keep fighting to get the mantle. The good news is there's a lot more room at the top than you think. It's not very crowded. So once you're there, you know, you can, you know, do a lot. What was it inside of you that when shit was going bad and negative that allowed you to pursue, or what did you tell yourself, or what was, you know, what kept you so determined?
Well, I pretty much believe that we're all given a gift when we're born. You know, we have a certain gift, whether it's music or math or people skills or business, or some people have to search for their gift. Sometimes it's not as obvious as it was with me when I knew at four, when my sisters put a ukulele in my hand and I learned three chords, I knew this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to live with a guitar in my hand and write music and make up songs. As I used to say, I just made up a song. You know, you didn't write them in those days. You made them up. And whatever that gift is, you know, I'm kind of spiritual. I'm not religious, but I am very spiritual, and I do believe in a higher power. And I believe it's your duty to make the most of your gift, your God-given gift. And that's what motivates me. I don't want to mess up. I don't want to squander a gift. I never got into drugs or chasing women or booze or whatever it is. I'm not a saint, but I never got into the depths of those things, because it would be an insult to what I was given. So I think that's the thing beyond all that motivates me.
To honor the gift you have and see it through.
Correct.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Thank you. I want to ask you a couple more questions about Vehicle. The guitar solo in this is great, man. It's very melodic, really. It's fast. And I was curious, how many takes did it take to get? Oh, you told me one take. Is that the guitar solo as well? Was that one take?
Yes, it is. That was take two. I couldn't even hear myself in the phones, which I think was a blessing, because I played out of instinct. One solo. I had to learn it afterwards because I didn't know what the hell I played.
So that was not worked out. That was like total improv.
Total improv. Total.
Awesome.
But when it was going down, I'm going to that. I go, this is going to be good, you know. But the funny thing is, when my producers played it back in the control room, it was buried, and they buried it because it was probably pretty bad. I went back next week. By this time, I had a fuzz tone. The Maestro fuzz tone had just come out. And I said, I'm going to redo that solo. Thank God they didn't erase the original, because I couldn't even begin to beat that solo. And Frank Rand says, let's put that old solo up. And there it was. Did you know that it's one of Jeff Beck's favorite solos? He name-checked that solo, and he's my hero. So, I mean, between that and Burt Bacharach saying he loved The Search Is Over, I'm a made man.
Yeah, man. That's awesome. So what guitar were you playing, if you remember?
Of course I remember. I broke a string on my Les Paul, and I borrowed Larry's Epiphone Riviera. Larry was playing B3 on that, so he relinquished his Riviera. And I picked up his Riviera. He still has that guitar. I played that solo in a Sunburst 1967 Epi Riviera.
It's funny. I've talked to so many players, and they've told me, if you want to buy a hollow body, go and get an old Epiphone, because there's nothing like them.
I totally agree. I use that guitar. I don't use Larry's, but I have one like it. There's something about that frequencator bridge. I know this is getting into geeky stuff, but it's perfect. It's perfect. A Les Paul has so much damn pressure over the tunematic, it almost chokes the sound. Give me a trapeze bridge anytime. It's got so much more life in it.
Very cool. After you hit vehicle, two questions. Did you know after you cut it that I think we're real, you know, I think this might be it?
Yeah. I mean, we knew we had something so much so that when we erased 13 seconds, we thought our careers were over. We knew we had something. Every time we would play vehicle at a dance, we were playing mainly dances, teen clubs, places with bizarre names like the purple cucumber, the pink, the pink fink, yes, the green gorilla, the cellar, and that was actually the cool place in Arlington Heights. The cellar was where all the ads. Well, we played there, but then we did field trips to see Cream and Jimi Hendrix, a few small bands like that, who would show up at the cellar and play. It was quite the opportunity. But we would try out new songs at these clubs and teen clubs. And every time we played Vehicle, this was, you know, 6 months before it was released, the dance floor would just fill up, and people were treating it like they had just heard it on the radio, which they hadn't.
I love the names of those places. They're so period-esque, you know? You don't have those names anymore.
I know.
What did this do for your confidence as a writer? And did any negative or problems arise from you from having such success at a young age like that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is when you get lucky with a song, you think you have all the answers. And then you write another one, you realize, no, I don't have all the answers, because we had stiff records that followed that. We had one that was a pretty major success, especially in Chicago. It was number one for 5 weeks. It's called L.A. Goodbye. In the Midwest, that's still considered one of the cherished songs in the Ides of March catalog. But it failed to spread, and for many reasons. Our record company were changing from external distribution to internal, and it just wasn't getting into stores. But I realized that not everything that came from my pen was going to be a big hit. And I got a little self-indulgent. You know, if you listen to the albums later on in the Ides career, I was, you know, talking about Eider Down and Round Cumulus Clouds. And, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. You know, come on, get back to basics, Jim. You know, if you want to be a movie star, take you to Hollywood, go back to that. You know? Anyway, so I had to learn the hard way that you have to stay focused. And you can't try to be Cat Stevens and Led Zeppelin and Poco and Crosby, Stills and Nash all in one album.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a good lesson. What did you take out of this entire experience now, looking back 50 years later? What was the big takeaway or the big lesson or thing you got out of that that meant the most?
I think what made the most and what resonates with me is a band and its chemistry. I mean, obviously, Survivor was a much bigger success weighed on this normal scale. But there's nothing like playing with a family, and the Ides of March were a family. We could go on a tour bus or be crammed in a U-Haul van; it wouldn't matter because we're all brothers. Survivor is very very successful, and I was friends with the band, but I never felt the family element that I felt with the Ides. So when I put the Ides back together in the '90s, it was really good. And you know, you talk about creative tensions, and all that is good, but if it gives you high blood pressure and heartburn, creative tensions ain't so good.
Yeah, for sure.
And I prefer the harmonious vibe of the Ides of March, or when I write with 38 Special, or now Dennis DeYoung, or any of the groups I write with. it's usually a copacetic feeling. And I find that that's the best formula overall.
Great. I want to talk about a couple of people you worked with, and if you could talk about how you connected with them initially and maybe a cool story about the experience. Brian Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Brian is a dear friend and one of my heroes. I mean, growing up with the Ides of March, it was the Beatles, it was Beach Boys, and it was Bacharach and David, you know, the three Beats. I used to love the songs that Bert Bacharach and Hal David wrote for Dionne Warwick. That was my standard high bar of songwriting. But Brian Wilson, you know, ever since, you know, Fun, Fun, Fun and I Get Around, and those were way up there. And I must have seen the Beach Boys five times in those days, usually playing the Eric Crown Theater at McCormick Place. And when I got the opportunity in 99, Joe Thomas, who was a friend of mine and Larry's, Larry Millis of the Ides, mutual friend Joe Thomas, and he produced and is still producing Brian and the Beach Boys, put me together with Brian in the same room with Larry Millis and Joe, and we started writing for his 1999 album called Imagination. And out of that came Your Imagination and a song called Dream Angel. And it was a great chemistry. You know, Brian would kind of go out to the piano at the studio and start kind of banging away. Well, his banging away is not like, you know, Schroeder's banging away. This guy could really
Schroeder.
Although we don't know how good he was. He might have been great. But anyway, Brian, when he's goofing around, is playing brilliant stuff. So our gig was turning on the tape recorder and capturing some of his genius, because he was like, oh, what's that? That's nothing. No, that's something. And so from that process, we started writing songs. About 5 years later, we got back together again. We're having Italian food at Beachy downtown. And it was myself, Brian Wilson, Larry Millis, and Joe Thomas. And we're talking about AM radio and how we miss AM radio, you know. And I said, there's something about hearing your song or anybody's song coming through the dashboard of your car, the compression, the lo-fi AM sound. I said, that's the way rock and roll should be heard. And Brian, you know, goes, yeah, that's why God made the radio. And I wrote that down because, you know, me, I'm a sucker for a good hook. That's why God made the radio. So over the next 5 years, it took that long to develop this song because of schedules and everything else. Finally, in 2011, we went to the studio, recorded that song, and it went to number one on Billboard in 2012, became the title of the Beach Boys reunion tour. That's why God made the radio. They were on Letterman. They were on Leno. They were on Good Morning America performing that song. One of the proudest moments of my life. Never thought I'd have a number one record with the Beach Boys. And now the same writing team with Brian are writing two albums, one a solo Brian album, and another documentary that is going to be a pretty big deal, a documentary of Brian's life.
That's fantastic. What a great story. But, you know, you obviously have your awareness, your antenna's up all the time, because had you not, you know, you're listening for stuff, looking for clues, you know, like maybe that's probably in line with your whole mission of, you know, fulfilling this gift that you have. And it's partly probably why you're so tuned in, you know, spiritually to what's going on around you. And you grabbed that hook and made it work, man. That's awesome.
Well, that is, you know, I'm always auditioning everything for an idea, for a concept, for a song title. You know, no one is safe. None of my friends are safe. You know, they'll say something that they don't know is brilliant. And I said, did you hear what you just said? No. I wrote it down. Listen to this. And they go, I said that? Yeah. It's the best title I heard today. You know, it's using everything around you. It's all your influences. The Beatles couldn't have existed without, you know, Chuck Berry and the Everly Brothers. You know, Stones, it was Chuck Berry and the blues artists. We all an amalgamation. The key and the trick is turning inspiration into something original, putting your own mark on it, and that's what I've tried to do.
Sammy Hagar.
Wonderful guy. He's my hero. He's the American dream. He's the personification of the American dream.
Totally.
Good-looking, long hair, sings great, plays great guitar, and is an entrepreneur that sold part of his company for Cabo Wabo for $80 million. He's my hero.
Yeah, man.
We still stay in touch. Every time he comes to Chicago, I hop on stage. I actually opened for him 2 years ago at Northerly Island in Chicago. A big thrill. I opened for him, then he had me come up on stage for Heavy Metal, and he's a dear friend, and he's still doing it. He's still doing it. Like I said, the day we wrote Heavy Metal, he picks me up at the airport in his red Ferrari Daytona convertible.
and not too noticeable.
Not too noticeable, but just wants to blend in with the crowd. Just like me. And I said, nice car. And he goes, yeah, nice country, America. I go, yeah, it is. And we cruised down to Mill Valley. And on the way, we picked up some Kona coffee, ground it there. And stoked by Kona coffee and good vibes, we cranked out Heavy Metal, because Eddie Loeffler, his manager at the time, who passed away since, said there's this new sci-fi animation. They're looking for a title cut. We got it to Bob Dostocki, who worked for the company, and he goes, this is it. And we had just done this really basic demo in his basement on a little TX cassette, multi-track cassette recorder, but it had the Jones, it had the mojo, you know. And then we cut it for real with Keith Olsen at his studio, Goodnight LA, and we've been friends ever since. That same day, we wrote another song called All Roads Leading Me Home, which got recorded by the Outlaws, but more recently, and we touched on this earlier off record, I did an album with the great Jennifer Batten and a terrific singer named Mark Shearer. We re-recorded All Roads Leading Me Back to You for that album, and I sent it to Sammy, and he loved it.
It's amazing, because if you listen to Heavy Metal, that song, obviously completely different from pretty much anything else you've written.
Yeah. Well, again, I love to, I'm like tofu. I like to absorb the flavor. You know, and that's, you know, if I'm sitting with Sammy Hagar, I'm not going to show him something wimpy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just a state of mind. And I never would have written headbangers in leather, sparks flying in the dead of the night. It all comes together when they shoot out the lights. 50,000 watts of power, and it's pushing overload. And then he goes, the beast is ready to devour all the metal it can hold. About to explode, about to overload. One-way ticket to midnight. Call it heavy metal. All right, let's go.
Yeah, man, that's it. That's awesome. The music and everything, that's such a cool song. I remember when I got that, I ran out and got the soundtrack right away when I heard that.
Well, yeah, and then we go, okay, let's think of the girls in the audience. Tight pants and lipstick. She's riding on the razor's edge. She holds her own against the boys. Cuts through the crowd just like a wedge.
That was revolutionary at the time. Nothing like that had been done before as a movie either, which was really cool.
It really was, and we're real proud of that.
You're originally from Berwyn?
Correct.
What kind of town is that? Or is it a city? Or
It's a town. It's about 30,000 people. All the Ides of March are from Berwyn, all the original four, which are still alive since 64. We're celebrating 55 years as a band next year. Little brick bungalows, not identical. They all had their little differences, you know, different Greek figures on every stairwell. But it was a great community and a very close knit. And we used to walk to school. I remember just walking to Piper School with my books. And that's the same thing we all did. Very blue collar. You know, everybody worked at the phone company. There was no lawyers, no doctors in the area. A famous bowler, Joe Bowman, was down the block. That was about, you know, the most famous person from Berwyn until the Ides of March came along.
How far away from there do you live now?
Only about 20 minutes. Larry still works there. He still lives there. Larry Millis, who was we consider the leader of the Ides of March, because he really is the one that knocked on my door and said, you got to quit that crummy band called the Renegades and join my band. And at first I, you know, resisted that, but then I go, yeah, you're right. I went to the rehearsal, and the first song we worked out was Tell Me Why by the Beatles. And they actually stayed on their harmony parts. And that was revolutionary for me. And they actually had a good drummer, so I went with them. But yeah, we Larry still lives in the same house that his mother and father lived in Berwyn, where we rehearsed, where we worked out vehicle. Sometimes we go down there and reflect of the way it was back then.
That's really cool. What was your childhood like growing up?
It was very, very pleasant. I had Binky and Johnny. They were my buds. They were a tad older than me. I was 5 and Binky was 6 and Johnny was 7. And we all had our ukuleles. There's a photo of me and Binky and Johnny on my front porch strumming the ukuleles, singing Jada or something. It was just happy. We made a kickmobile together with roller skates and your prototypical childhood. It was an empty lot where we played marbles and played baseball. It was pretty great.
You have any brothers or sisters growing up with you?
Two older sisters. Janice was 12 years older. Alice Ann was 10 years older. Janice is no longer with us. Alice Ann is still alive and well. They're the ones that used to bring back the little 45s and put them on our RCA Victor changer. We used to stack those things way higher than was recommended. And they had good taste. They would bring back early Johnny Cash on the Sun label, Elvis Presley on the Sun label, early RCA. They would bring back Everly Brothers, Sandro and John, anybody that, and they had such good taste. And I was, even though I was 4 or 5 years old, I had a catalog of songs to listen to that most 5-year-olds just didn't have.
Because of these older sisters.
That's the older sisters, and they were hip. They were the blue jean hot gals, It was really cool. So I had a leg up, of starting that early.
Over your career, I know that there was obstacles that you had to overcome, because we all have them, because life is not easy and it's not for the weak. What were some of the biggest obstacles that you've had to overcome throughout this journey for you, either personally, music, or business related?
Yeah. Well, I think I touched on some of them. And it was just dealing with failure, really, whether it's the Ides of March, not being able to follow up the success of vehicle, or Jim Peterick not being able to gain traction with my solo career when, I decided I wanted to be Cat Stevens, that didn't work. I'm no Paul Simon. I'm no Cat Stevens. I'm a different animal. It was learning what I am. It was a survivor when we really had a fairly non-successful album following Eye of the Tiger called Caught in the Game, when there was no hits on that album. And it's like, do you give up or do you keep going? It was also dealing with the fact that I did not quite feel like myself in terms of exploring my talents in Survivor. I don't regret it, but I took a different role in that band. I was very frustrated. How do I deal with an entity that is successful, but that's really not as fulfilling as I'd like it to be? And that was difficult. So all those things I was dealing with, but you don't give up and you don't cry in your beer. You just keep going.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. If you had to go back and give younger Jim Peterick advice, excuse me, what advice would you have liked to hear, or would you have benefited from, assuming you were open to listening?
Oh man, so many things. I mean, one thing, after the success of Vehicle, I kind of had that gruff sound and in my voice, which was very marketable. I started singing that way, and it started tearing up my throat. And my dad would come to see me at a show, and he would go, Jimmy, you're going to ruin your voice. No, that's bulletproof, Dad. Well, guess what? I ruined my voice. And, there's a thing that we singers use called a falsetto. Frankie Valli made a lot of money out of that falsetto, as did Brian Wilson. And it disappeared. And I'll tell you, it was like losing a body part for me, because my vocal cords were ravaged. So and it took me years to really get it back. And I would recommend anybody that's a singer. Take care of the instrument. Learn how to sing. Learn how to warm up. Learn how to control your voice and not ruin it. Don Burns, when he sings live, everybody thinks he's a great singer, but he's not a loud singer necessarily. He knows how to use a mic. You know, I didn't. I thought I had to be the whole PA system in one guy. Also, and this is a cautionary tale, not so much personal as people I've witnessed, wear ear protection. If you're a guitar player, if you're a drummer, if you're any on stage, man, you know, it's very, very important to protect your ears. It's the best calibration you have as a musician. Also, I would recommend anybody who's a singer-songwriter, stick up for your ideas. Don't get discouraged. And I've learned this. You know, I'm no different than some of the great writers that you never feel would have a crisis of confidence. Paul McCartney would read a bad review and get depressed and believe it, you know. And I'm the same way. I would have people say, I don't hear the song. I just, don't hear it. And I wouldn't play it for anyone else. Guess what? If you believe in a song, believe in the song. Everybody's got opinions, you know, the old saying.
Yeah.
And so if you really believe in, whether it's a song or whatever it is, stand up for your beliefs. Don't just take one person's opinion. You know, if 10 people start saying it sucks, you might start considering it.
Yeah. 50 million Frenchmen can't be wrong kind of thing.
Can't be wrong.
I'm afraid to ask you this question because you told me you have 200 guitars and I could just see the wheels spinning in your head after I ask it to you. But what's your go-to guitar right now, and maybe what other two would round out your top three?
Good question. And it is trying to like choose your favorite child. People say, "What's your favorite song?" I said, "No, I can't judge." Although I usually pick the Searches over. But with guitars, you know, I don't really take vintage guitars out on stage much because they're going to get damaged. Either my belt buckle or careless, someone bumping into the stand or whatever it is. I'm not going to take my 58 Les Paul custom mint condition guitar on the road. I'd rather use it in the studio or just look at it hanging there real nice. I'm not going to be taking my 54 Stratocaster on the road. So I play some great reissues on stage, but if, you know, we just did this Cornerstones of Rock show. It was a PBS special that was all over the country on all the public PBS stations. And I pulled out my 1968 Les Paul that I played vehicle on. And I hadn't played it in years. And man, the thing just spoke to me. And luckily, it's already been relicked, as they say, but from real road use, the back is just totally almost carved out from my big belt buckles from the 70s, you know.
Yeah.
And when I got that old Les Paul out, I go, now I miss this guitar. So I have to say that's my desert island guitar. And it's screwed up enough where I don't have to worry about it. It looks like hell. But I rediscovered it when I taped the special. So I wanted that authentic vehicle sound when I played it. So I would say that's my go-to guitar.
It's 68 Les Paul.
Yeah.
Burst, gold top. And it's got the original Les Paul from that period pickups?
Well, here's the thing. Yes, it does. There was a guitar store on Wabash. That's where all the guitar stores, musical instruments stores were in the Chicago Loop. And there was a place called Guitar Gallery. Not Guitar Center, years, decades before Guitar Center. Guitar Gallery. It's owned by a couple of, I don't know if they're Russian, but they spoke with a thick accent. And they were the kind of guys that would come in there, you know, at age 15, 16 with the eyes. Then I'd pick up a 335. When I picked up that guitar, I just knew it was magic. So I'd pick up a fine 355 Gibson. And first of all, they were nervous as hell that I was going to drop it or something. And Eric or Wolfgang, either of the two guys would go, "Wolfgang, I like that name. Jim, that guitar is too good for you. You cannot buy that guitar." It didn't matter about the money. "No, it's too good for you. You're not ready for that guitar."
Ready for that guitar.
It's too good. So, I mean, that gave it more of a challenge, you know. But a couple of days later, a couple of weeks later, Paul Staples, who was the cool young guy at the counter, I said, I'm really interested in a Les Paul. I love those guitars. I saw Keith Richards play one, you know. And he says, well, I just did a custom order from Gibson. They're just about to reissue the Gold Top, but they're doing it with the P90 Sopar pickups. And they're noisy and stuff like that. I ordered two with factory humbuckers.
Oh.
And I have the most rare. They only made a couple in 68 with humbuckers. And they had black surrounds instead of – they had all black hardware, which is really unusual on a Gold Top. It had the black pickguard, the black surrounds.
Hmm.
Gave it a real evil kind of cool look. So when I got that guitar, that became my go-to guitar with the eyes. I did all my touring with it. And then, again, I took it out of the dusty case, started using it again, and it's on stage with me every show.
What did you pay for that back then?
That was expensive. Oh, God. It was like something like $350, you know?
Wow.
That was a lot of bucks, yeah. Man. I mean, that's when a Telecaster was selling for $189. And this was like the way up there.
Wow. What a cool – that's a great guitar, man. So 68 Les Paul Gold Top. What would be the next one?
When I was with Survivor, you know, we used to get these dealers that would be coming to our shows. It's like instead of drugs, they'd be dealing in these guitars, which is a lot safer.
The pusher man.
Yeah, right. Just as habit for me. So one guy, I think it came from the Midwest somewhere. I think we were in like St. Louis. He opened a tweed case, and it was a 56 Telecaster with the white guard. You know, originally they had the black guard. But I always liked the white guard tellies. And this one was a little bit worn. I'd say about an 8 out of a 10 scale. But I plugged it in. He brought an amp backstage, and it just roared. And I called the telly that thinks it's a Les Paul. Real loud guitar. And I play that like all the time. And it's not fancy, but it's got the mojo, you know. But the brand that I've been most associated with in the last 7-8 years is Mynarik, M-I-N-A-R-I-K. I know they're West Coast. I'm going to find out more about the company. I think they're out of Seattle. But I subscribe to Vintage Guitar, and that's one of my downfalls because you look in that magazine and it's like, porn.
Yeah, porn. Guitar porn.
That's what it is. And there was this picture of this amazing guitar. It was called a Mynarik Inferno. And the back of the guitar is carved like flames. And anyway, I found one online at Miami Vintage. And it was really cool because they only made a few of these. It's a crushed mirror ball top. So it looks like it refracts the light like crazy. And then also at Miami Vintage, he had a one-of-a-kind NAMM show Mynarik Inferno with a tin top that was made by a custom tin guy. And they called it the Tinferno, one-of-a-kind guitar. From there, it led to 5 other Mynariks that I had custom painted by Kat Clausen, a local artist here, with just amazing ones called the Badass Bee, which images of bees, and another one called the She-Devil with the woman, another one, just crazy stuff. By the way, this is something you asked me, some of my ventures. I have a guitar calendar. Of course, we're almost halfway through the year for 2000.
We've been talking about 2 minutes old stuff, Jim. 2018,
yeah. It's a vintage guitar calendar. At least 75 of my favorite guitars posed all over my house. It's called Guitars That Followed Me Home.
Where can people get that?
You can get it on jimpeterick.com.
Awesome. For sale.
And it's on Amazon, but I recommend going direct to Jimbo here. But I'm probably doing one for 2019 with a few different instruments that I didn't even use in this one. But like, for instance, I pose all my 12 strings in my home theater, and I call it 12 string cinema. Then I have another one posed on my kitchen counter, which you've seen in the background, called gluten-free, fresh-caught guitars. And it's all these oddballs that I've collected through the years. But it's sold really well. It's been sold in like bookstores around Chicago and stuff. And I still sell it at shows.
You're probably like a local celebrity, I would imagine.
Yeah, just ask my wife. It's
I know that's an awkward question. Like, you're a local celebrity. I meant that like you're well known locally. You know, not that people are like bowing. You know, like you're like the guy.
Well, no, you're never a prophet in your own home. You have to realize that.
Yeah, I do.
you have to know that. At the supermarket, you know, I go alone now because if I go with Karen, people are stopping me for photos and autographs. And while Karen's picking out the best piece of broccoli, it's not conducive, you know? So, I mean, I love it because, hey, I signed up for the program. You know, yeah. I wouldn't have purple hair and dress weird if I didn't want to be noticed, you know?
Yeah.
But, it's pretty crazy in Chicago.
That's nice, though. You know? It's nice, man. It's like a lifetime of achievement, you know? It's like you work super hard. You know, you're known for a positive thing. It's not like you're a celebrity because, you know, you had the big scandal. You know, you did something that really meant a lot to you, that was genuine and soulful. That's cool, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and the people couldn't be nicer. Couldn't be nicer. And the stories I hear based on The Eye of the Tiger are just incredibly, moving. People that have fought cancer to that song and come out on the other side. People that have gotten out of wheelchairs and into rehab using that song as a crutch, marathoners, runners, cyclers, corporate ladder people. It's been, it's no bigger blessing to a songwriter to have a song that motivates people. That's, a real blessing for me.
It's a very redemptive song, in character. It's like, the underdog. It's the song for the underdog.
Well, that's right. Rising up to the challenge of your rival. It is. It's rising up back on the street. It is the underdog. And I've always been from Berwyn, and Chicago's the second city. You feel like the underdog.
Yeah.
You know, times. And that has fueled my, my motivation.
Are there any guitar players that influenced your playing that people would be surprised to hear?
Well, as I said, Jeff Beck. It may not come across, but I was very influenced by Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, Jimi Hendrix. I can't even touch the hem of his garment, although I try, that Wind Cries Mary, I learned that song every lick, and I still use those, as did Neil Schon, a lot of that stuff from that song. I mean, Hendrix was the king. I love Gary Moore. I think one of the most underrated guitarists. I got to meet him. I was working with Deep Purple in New England, and he came over to the house. He lived next door. And I got to meet my hero. I got to play one of the Stratocasters, and we jammed a little bit. Just amazing. Amazing.
What would be your – this is a tough question too. Like top three Desert Island discs, but with some – I'll cut you some slack. You don't have to put them in order. And just for today, could change tomorrow. Just like your knee-jerk reaction for now.
Sure. Sergeant Pepper would be maybe on the top of my list. That album, really changed music and changed me. I remember, putting it on the turntable and playing that first side or the second side. Whichever one had Lucy in the Sky and Day in the Life. I think Day in the Life is the one that just blew my mind. We started doing it actually in the Odd Show, our own version of it. But I was sitting in the Lazy Boy in my parents' living room, and I was listening to this music, and I was not high. I didn't do drugs of any kind. And I started having this experience where my feet were going over my head, and I was revolving backwards in the chair. It had that powerful of a psychedelic effect on me. I don't know what element of the music, or it's just the combination of the vibes, but I never felt that powerful of a feeling listening to an album. So that was life changing, that album. So that's number one. I really love Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, which was very influential to the Beatles, and vice versa. They kind of had that friendly competition of trying to beat each other for the greatest album of all time.
Sloop John B was on that, right?
I believe it was.
Yeah, beautiful song, man.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, for me, the ones that stand out the most was Caroline No. It was Wouldn't It Be Nice. And my favorite song of all time, God Only Knows, which I cite as my favorite all-time song. Another album that really just got me was the whole Stevie Wonder series of albums that started with Talking Book, went to Intervisions, went to
Songs in the Key of Life, I think.
Key of Life. But I think it was that first album, well, not the first album, but the first album that hit me, Talking Book, that changed me. So that would be probably my third Desert Island disc.
Cool. Good combo there, man. Tough question. What do you like most about yourself? I know. It's like
my extreme modesty.
Your modesty.
No, I don't know. I think what I like most about myself is the ability to shed off the negativity and clear a path. You know, negativity doesn't really bring anything, but we all fall into, you know, being down in the dumps or looking at a glass as half empty. I clear that away because I want to have a path moving forward. So I think that I'm the proudest of being able to do that pretty much on a daily basis, cut away the chaff and go straight down the middle.
What was the trigger to, were you always like that inherently, or is there something that happened that said, hey, I got to cut this shit out and get all the toxic crap out of my head?
Yeah. Well, one thing I didn't tell you about my childhood, you know, it sounded idyllic, but, I had a condition that they didn't even have initials for in those days. And now it would probably be ADD, ADHA, who knows what it would be.
Yeah.
But in those days, it's just, Jimmy, you're a worrier. That was my mother. Why are you worrying so much? Well, it wasn't just worrying. I was lamenting over things. I was afraid. I was afraid of a tornado coming. I was looking at every horizon for a mushroom cloud because of the nuclear scare. I was looking in the paper every day for strontium 90 levels in the atmosphere. I read Rachel Carson's The Silent Spring, and it freaked me out about the environment. This is at age 10. I was way ahead of my time with environmental worries. I worried about everything, and it was almost debilitating. And you know what? The first time I stepped on stage, I was part of a thing called the Talented Teen Search over at the Cermak Plaza in Berwyn. And I had my original first guitar, the Wandre, that my dad bought me for Christmas when I was 11. And I brought my little amp. I stood on stage and I sang Kansas City, the Wilbur Harrison. Go to Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women there. Okay, so I'm hearing my voice over the parking lot. The people there, I end the song, people applaud. And all of a sudden, my fears, my worry, my obsessions went into remission. And I go, okay, now I know what I have to do to keep those monsters at bay. But the funny thing is, the worries would creep in another 2 weeks when I was off of the euphoria of being on stage and getting the acceptance of the crowd. Guess what? I'd have to perform again. It's been a cycle where I know that I have to dose myself with music and writing and creativity. Otherwise, I turn into that worrywart guy. So it's my best medicine has always been music.
Wow, that's really interesting. So how did you, bearing in mind that you have all this inherent tendency to worry, what did you do or what do you do outside of, you know, performing? Like you said, that's one of the things you like the most about yourself, your ability to shut that off. And I could see why it means even more to you. What do you do consciously to not let shit creep in?
Well, shit's going to creep in. But when I'm not performing, it seems like I'm always writing. And writing is a silent combat. I guess you'd call a compulsive songwriter. On a given day, I might write two songs. And they're not all great. They're not all going to be, you know, Eye of the Tiger. But it's a form of therapy.
Yeah, it's the process.
It is. And Karen keeps me engaged in other ways. We go on hikes, we go on bike rides. That puts me out of the worry zone, too. All the things that are good for you, thank God, keep me out of the worry zone.
That's great, man.
So it's working.
Do you do you watch news or anything like that?
I do.
Yeah, you know, I have not watched a news episode in close to 30 years. And when I started first studying self-development and stuff, they talked about how in your subconscious mind, that's what's fertile. And, you know, you're typically most open to that last thing in the day. And I said, shit, I'm never watching news again because I just didn't want negative crap. You got enough stuff to deal with that, like, is in your plate. I just didn't want to introduce that.
No, I totally understand that. I'm not a news junkie by any means, but I will tune in. I just think the news medias are totally, totally awful. Awful. Yeah. And because ratings are based on negativity.
Yeah.
It's not based on positive stories. No, everybody wants to hear, is the head dead yet? They don't want to hear of miraculous stories.
No, totally, man. Yeah. Okay, the flip side, if there's something you could change about yourself, what would that be?
Well, I'd rather not be a warrior, you know, let's face it. But then again, it probably wouldn't have brought out the things that it's brought out in me. I wish I didn't have to watch my weight on a daily basis because I love to eat. But in the long run, I'll probably live longer because I'm eating better.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was a fat kid. I was, you know, I mean, the Eye of the Tiger video, I can't watch it. I look like a refrigerator. Why? Why they let me wear a white sweatshirt? You know, white is the most expanding color of all.
Yeah.
You know, so when I'm walking down that street with Survivor down in the red light district of San Francisco, which is where we taped it, I'm just totally embarrassed. You know, how did I let myself get there? Finally, by vital signs, I'd slimmed down. I went to we were cutting vital signs, and myself and one of the roadies went to a diet doctor in Marin County. And for that month, I went on 500 calories a day.
Wow.
And I lost like 30 pounds. So by the time the photo shoot hit for Vital Signs, it's looking pretty good.
Yeah. You know?
And thank God for that. But then, of course, I put it on in the late 80s again. And that's when I knew I had to cut back. So about 8 years ago, I went on a really good, basically paleo diet that emphasizes high protein and meat and fish, and it really seemed to work.
And I got to tell everybody listening, literally, I think the first or second thing I asked Jim when we started, I said, holy shit, man, you're in really good shape. What are you? Because he's really slim and he's fit, you know? And I said, what do you do to stay in shape? I was curious because I'm the same way. I have the same fat genetics and I have to like meticulously watch everything I eat. Got to work out all the time because it's just a crap feeling, as you know, when you're out of shape, you know, especially if you're fat as a kid.
Well, right. And it's a crap feeling when you finish a whole stack of Pringles and you feel like crap.
Yeah, totally. So that was just want to tell everybody, Jim's saying he's got a weight. He doesn't have a weight problem. He looks great, but I get it, man. I totally get that.
It's another battle.
Best childhood memory.
Wow, that's easy. Every year, my parents would drive their, first there was a 52 Chrysler and then a 57 Chrysler with the big fins. We'd drive down to Florida every summer to visit my aunt and uncle down in Fort Myers. And so, you know, I'd be 5 years old. I'd be in the back seat with Alice, Ann, and Janice, and my mother and dad arguing in the front seat. And we'd be in the back seat in our heaven, strumming ukuleles, playing camp songs like With Someone Like You and Maybe and Jada, Jada, Jing, Jing, Jay, and all these corny, great songs. And then my sisters would start tickling me and teasing me, and you know, because I was their little plaything, for God's sakes, but I loved it. And my mother would turn around and go, Jimmy, do you want to sit up? Do you want to sit in front with us or be tortured in the back with your sisters? And I go, tortured in the back with my sisters, please. Those were the best times, going through the Smoky Mountains, stopping at these little motels. We'd find one with a vacancy and the coldest air conditioning in the lobby, and that's the one that we would choose. Finally making it down to Fort Myers, we stayed at the Sea Chest Motel right on the bay, you know, mm-hmm. the ocean. And then we would go down to my uncle's soft serve ice cream place.
Oh, there you go.
He owned the Dairy Dream or whatever it was, and he let me scoop on the pineapple onto the sundaes, and I thought I was a big boy.
What a great story, man. Thank you. That's a really nice memory. It's about Fort Myers, about an hour and a half south of here. Person who's had the biggest influence on your life?
Well, I guess my father. I really loved and respected my father because, you know, he was kind, a very kind man, very supportive of my career. And I guess he really was my hero. You know, I didn't think about it at the time. It was later when I really realized how important he was in my life. You know, sometimes you're so close to someone when they're alive that you don't even realize how vital he was. And I remember it was 3 months before he passed away from a heart attack. He had a minor heart attack. He was in the hospital. And then he got out of the hospital. He came over to the house. I said, yeah, I just wrote 2 songs for Rocky III. And he said, oh, really? I said, yeah, I really want to play you one. And I played him Ever Since the World Began, which was the ballad that Frankie and I wrote for Rocky III. And I played it for him. And I said, you really inspired this one because there's a line in there. We're just another piece of the puzzle, just another part of the plan. How one life touches the other is so hard to understand. Still, we walk this road together. We only go as far as we can. And we have waited for this moment in time ever since the world began. And I thought of him and his struggle and his heart attack. And I didn't know how many more miles he had to go on that road, but we had the moment. And he goes, well, there's a second song. What's that one? I said, oh, that's another thing called Eye of the Tiger.
Well, that's a real nice moment you got to share with him, though.
Yeah, it was a great moment. And so I'm in L.A. I went to L.A. to finish up Eye of the Tiger, and Frankie was there mixing it. And I got a call from my wife. She said, you better come home. We don't know if Dad's going to make it to the morning. I go, what? Yeah, he's back in the hospital. So I booked my plane. I heard one last play back of Eye of the Tiger, and I took the flight, not knowing what he was going to be, alive or dead. But that morning at my apartment complex in L.A., the Oak Tree Apartments, where Survivor was staying, in the morning at 5 a.m., I got this amazing pounding in my chest. Pounding. I couldn't get air. I actually walked out of the apartment complex, got on all fours, gasping for air. That was the exact moment my father died, given two hours a difference. I expired the same time he did. I get to the airport kind of knowing what that was, and my wife picks me up and says, he didn't make it. And I go, yeah, I know. And that connection of father and son, or from daughter and father, or son and daughter, doesn't matter, friend to friend. You cannot tell me we don't have connections that cannot be explained.
Wow. Thanks, man. That was, thank you for sharing that. Any bad habits?
Well, we talked about Pringles, so I can get that out of the way.
Wait a minute. What's worse, your Pringles issue or your guitar?
Yeah, the guitar. I belong to Guitarist Anonymous.
Guitarist Anonymous.
Yeah, I am powerless against a good deal on a Les Paul 12-step program. And no, nothing works. It's really, you know, I love potato chips, and Pringles aren't really my favorite. I like the.
That's really good to hear, because, you know, if you're going to eat them, man, like, yeah, eat some thick kettle chips or something.
I like the kettle chips. You know, I really do. I can go through a whole bag of those puppies, you know. As far as bad habits, I don't have many. I like a good martini now and then. I don't consider that a bad habit. And I like it really specific. I usually go with like a Tanqueray 10, no vermouth, shaken beyond cold, like crystalline, no vermouth. Blue cheese olives. I'm a happy guy. But like I said, that's a little mood elevation. I don't consider it a bad habit, and I don't do it at all on a daily basis. And sometimes, you know, Karen will join me in one and just have a good time.
That's so relaxing, though. I mean, like for me, and I'm, you know, just to sit and have a drink with my wife is like, you know, when you have a vibe like that where you're so. It's just really relaxing, I find it, you know. It's not something I do often, but it's just very cool, you know. It's very mellow.
Well, right. And I proved to myself years ago that I'm not a problem drinker. I'm not a guy that can hold their liquor. I always say when someone can hold their liquor, they've got a problem.
Yeah.
Because they can keep going, and I can't. I'll fall asleep, you know. So I know I can handle one drink, and but, you know, that's just for me, it's just a little relaxation at the end of a hard week or something.
Do you have any hobbies outside of music?
Just guitars, you know. That's my main hobby. Like Karen is like a prism. She tries to break up my light into other paths, you know. And she takes me on trips and to museums and all this stuff. And I'm a good follower, but I'm not really an initiator, because really everything I do, my really passions are linked to music, whether it's guitars or songwriting camps or, you know, I'll tell you one thing I've really enjoyed is a ranch called Rancho La Puerta. It's not one of these cushy, you know, pampered spa kind of places. It's in Tecate, Mexico. We go down there and we stay for a week and eat nothing but organic food. And this time they paid my way because I did a songwriting seminar at the ranch.
Awesome.
It was so good. And every morning you're up at 6:15, you're hiking, you're, you know, up, you know, huge, well, they're not huge mountains, but they're inclines. Let's put it that way. And an hour and a half later, your ass is firmly kicked. And then you go to a meditation class if you want, or guided meditation, or, you know, various, you know, you could even do jewelry making, although I never did it. And at the end, there's a big party, and I play for that, too, with the mariachi band, which I christened Los Benditos. They love me. And in those times, I kind of put the music off a bit. And if something pops in my head, I always got my iPhone and I do a voice memo and I put it away. I try not to check messages more than every couple of days. Hmm. I tell everybody I'm at this ranch, don't bug me. But things come up. But I really cherish that, and we're going to do it again next year. That'll be the third year we do it.
It's called Rancho La Puerta in Mexico.
Correct. Tecate, Mexico. I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful experience. And now we have friends that we try to book the same week because they become friends.
That's very nice, man. You sound like you do a pretty good job balancing.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
It really is. And you can't just do one thing. You lose your life, really.
Well, especially because you're always, remember, like that antenna, you're kind of like always on, but it sounds like you can like moderate it and send yourself a memo. You don't have to, holy shit, man, let me write the song now. You can say, hey, here's the basic and the idea, and I'll deal with it later if it's meant to be.
That's terrific. That's the way to do it. And you could keep the plate spinning. I mean, on any given day, I could be writing a song with 38 Special, Brian Wilson, and, you know, Mike Reno. He just left the studio 2 days ago, Loverboy. We wrote a song together. I'm doing a New World Stage album. This is something I kind of wanted to plug.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah. World Stage is something, when I left Survivor in 96, what do I do now? You know, and one thing I really wanted to do was to bring together a lot of the people I met in the business, either toured with or wrote with in the past. And in 2001, I released an album called Jim Peterick and World Stage. It was on World Stage International Records, which is just a fancy name for my own label. And it did really well. And I had Dennis DeYoung and join me on a song, and Kevin Cronin, Tom Kiefer's Cinderella, Henry Paul, on and on. It was just an amazing outpouring of friendship and great vibes. And that was in 2001. And since then, every year I've been doing a World Stage concert, at least one, sometimes two, usually in January, where I invite these guests to these shows. And every year it's a little different, but my stalwart guys, it's almost always Kelly Kagan and Night Ranger. It's many times it's Rick Emmett of Triumph. Sometimes it's Kevin Cronin. Sometimes it's always different.
Great writers and great players there, man.
I mean, and every year it sells out in a heartbeat because everybody knows I'm going to bring a great show. It's not all on my shoulders. I'm sharing the stage with all these amazing talents. Well, I got a message from Frontiers, which is my label for most of my output in the 2000s. It's a label out of Milan, Italy. Serafino Perugino, not too Italian, is a big mentor of mine. You know, Kladner was my mentor in the 80s, and Serafino is really my mentor in the 2000s. He's responsible for putting out my six Pride of Lions albums, where Toby Hitchcock and I share the singing duties. I write all the songs. He's done other releases where he's used my songs. And then he did the Mark Shearer, Jim Peterik album of 3 years ago. He did not do the Jennifer Batten album that went on Melodic Rock Records, Andrew McNeese, who has a very successful Melodic Rock site. But the point is, he called me about, 6 months ago, Maestro. And I'm sure I'm not the only one he calls Maestro, especially when I found out he calls Dennis DeYoung Maestro. So I'm not going to be flattered by that anymore. But I was for a while. Anyway, Maestro, you must do another world stage album. It's time. And, we signed a deal. And for the last 3 months, I've been writing and getting commitments from various artists. People have been coming into town to write songs. And the latest one was Mike Reno, who came into town. We wrote a really good rocker. What I try to do when I co-write a song, like I said, the tofu analogy, when I write a song with someone like a Mike Reno or anyone I write with, I try to put a little of their signature in it and a little of my signature in it. So my sensibility is kind of what I did with 38 Special. Those aren't Survivor songs. They're very specifically songs that I wrote for and with 38 Special, where I combine their Southern rock roots with my pop sensibilities, and that created Hold On Loosely and Caught Up In You and Fantasy Girl. That was that combo play. Well, I did that with Mike. I mean, probably his finest moment was either Almost Paradise, which he sang with Ann Wilson, which is one of the great power ballads of our decade, or Working for the Weekend. I mean, it's an earworm from heaven, you know? So I used that beat to create a song. I'm not going to say the title because it's too early to put it out there, but we wrote a great song and demoed it. So I try to, channel some of what they are famous for.
Where can people find information about the world stage stuff?
Well, on my Facebook, I'm very current with, and I tell everybody who I'm writing with on that given week and who I'm in the studio with. So I guess Facebook is the most immediate way, but it also again, jimpeterik.com.
Okay, great. Hey, Jim, I got two questions for you, and I cannot thank you enough, man. This has really been great, and I appreciate everything.
Well, if I can stroke your ego a little bit, and I don't usually do this, but I really enjoying myself because I'm very used to people that either don't know anything about me and think they do, or just ask the boilerplate stuff. And I'm really enjoying talking with you because I'm saying stuff that is sincere and from the heart, but some of the stuff I've never said before. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's my pleasure, honestly. And thanks for those kind words. I'm always awkward with compliments, but thanks, man. Two questions. What's the most important lesson your business has taught you?
Oh, man. I think the basic thing is stick up for yourself. Stick up for your rights. I'm very easily conditioned by the wrong personalities, people that will either intimidate me through words or will intimidate me by a kind of passive aggression, which is even more deadly. People that just walk out of a room and you wonder what they're saying.
I hate passive aggressive, man, to be honest with you.
It's deadly. And it's funny, a lot of passive aggressives have a lot of power because people, unbelievably, even in high, are basically insecure. So when something isn't said, a person like me will believe the worst. And that's a powerful enemy. So I try to combat that and just believe in yourself. I just read the Jonathan Cain book called Don't Stop Believing. Terrific book. And we reconnected after all these years because I did a book review on his book. And that song, Don't Stop Believing, well, you know, what was once brilliant is now a cliche. But thank God we have cliches like Don't Stop Believing and Eye of the Tiger. Because if it's a cliche, it means that it was so prevalent in our society, it's become almost rote. But never take those ideas for granted. And in his book, he addresses that, of standing up for yourself, standing up to the passive aggressions, to the bullies. I was bullied in grade school. Tom and Gary Booth, the tough kids from two blocks away, pushed me in a pile of leaves and stuck a switchblade at my throat. And for what reason? Because they could.
Yeah.
And I learned what bullying was all about. And I vowed never to cater to bullies, A, and B, never to be one. So all those lessons you learn.
Thanks, man. Stick up for your rights. And the last question, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of this change has been deliberate and intentional? And how much has just been a natural part of aging?
Well, I'm probably more confident than I've ever been. I've become kind of like the 19-year-old Jim Peterick, not so much in my aches and pains, which I have a few, but it more in the way I carried myself when vehicle was running the charts. I mean, we all have that one point in our life where it all comes together and you're wearing the right clothes and you're saying the right things. And I was the front man of the Ides of March, and I wasn't married and had the world in front of me. And that's the way I feel again. About 8 years ago, I lost the weight. I decided I want to do something with my hair. And I, with Ross Bartolome, my salon owner, how about purple? Okay. So I became the guy with the purple hair. And it empowered me.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I gained confidence for having a look, having a brand. Suddenly I was proud of my brand like I was when I was 19. Not afraid to speak my mind, not afraid to see the public and to engage in the public, not shrink back, but to press the flesh, to shake the hands. I'm good at it. I've become good at it. And I think that's the important difference. And I don't plan to go back to the wallflower that I felt I was playing keyboards with Survivor.
Man, good for you. You deserve it. You've put out a lot of good vibes. You might as well get them back.
Right on.
Hey, I want to tell, first of all, honestly, thank you so much. This has really been a joy. Honestly, I've really enjoyed talking to you, getting to know you. So thank you for your time. I want to tell people where you are and where to support you. Okay, it's Jim Peterick, Peterik. First of all, you can find Jim on social media, Facebook, Official Jim Peterick. He is also the author of Songwriting for Dummies, which is obviously all over. And if you want to learn a little bit about songwriting, he's probably not a bad guy to listen to. Through the Eye of the Tiger is his autobiography. Again, that's on Amazon. And does any place else sell books? Does Barnes & Noble exist anymore?
Yes, they do. And Barbara's exists also, which is a great chain. And then individual bookstores. It's funny, they're not as popular as they used to be, but there's still a strong following for the printed word.
Thank God for that, man. Also, he's got a calendar with all his guitars that you can get on jimpeterick.com. Again, that's Jim, Peterik.com. He is touring with the Ides of March. Go out and support him and check him out and enjoy the show. And you can find that at the Ides of March. Ides is I-D-E-S. And that's it. I think everything else that Jim is doing is on jimpeterick.com. And check him out at Jim Peterick and World Stage coming up soon. Any final words of wisdom, man? Anything I missed?
Only thing we missed, I talked a little about it, but the Cornerstones of Rock, which is touring now.
Yeah.
And we're going to be playing Milwaukee Fest coming up. It's the bands that really were pivotal in the Chicago scene. And there's a vast following for each of these bands, and collectively we sell out all the time. It's the Ides of March, the Buckinghams, which had many, many hits, Kind of a Drag, Susan, Hey Baby, They're Playing Our Song, Don't You Care, big CBS act. The New Colony Six, I Will Always Think About You, Shadows of Night, G-L-O-R-I-A, Gloria. I'm missing one band. Oh, the Crying Shames, who were our heroes growing up. Never really broke out in a huge way nationally, but one of the most popular bands in Chicago. They had a nationwide hit called Sugar and Spice. So we're touring with that ensemble, and it's just been hugely successful. So watch your calendars for that. We're going to be playing the Arcata Theater in November in St. Charles, Illinois. It'll be an instant sellout. So check it out.
And where can people find that info? Is that on your website as well?
Yes, it's on jimpeterick.com. It's on theadsofmarch.com. It's all linked to the Cornerstones as well.
Awesome. Thank you. So go out and support the Cornerstones and say hey to Jim and tell him, you know, tell him your Eye of the Tiger story, man. I think he'd like that.
I would love that. Please bring it on.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks so much again to Jim Peterick for his time and candor and kindness and for sharing all those really cool stories. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.